Nicole Sandler.
You're listening to Nicole Sandler on Air America Radio.
All right, so we just spoke with Paul Brandis of the Talk Radio News Service, who was traveling with the president, and he called us from Beijing, China. And we talked a little bit about the fact that the president had this so-called town hall meeting on censorship that was highly censored. And so it's an interesting segue to our next guest. Connie Schultz is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, who actually took a leave of absence from her job at the paper when her husband was running for the U.S. Senate. He was elected, we all know and love Senator Sherrod Brown from Ohio. And Connie Schultz then wrote a book, which is sort of a journal of her experiences on the campaign trail, called And His Lovely Wife, A Memoir from the Woman Beside the Man. And Connie, I've been a fan of your work for a while now, and I thank you so much for coming on the air tonight.
Well, thank you, Nicole. It's great to be here. It's great to join another night person.
Ah, yes. Well, I hold court here nightly.
So I said
it's an interesting segue from Paul Brandis, who's in Beijing, to what you were telling me on the phone earlier today, and is in your latest blog entry up at Cleveland.com, which is end the silence on abuse of women. Now, in Cleveland, this is a bigger story. Why don't you fill us in on what has unfolded there in recent weeks?
Well, what has unfolded is a tragedy that seems to have no end. I mean, we anticipate that they're going to be finding even more. But right now, 11 bodies of African-American women were found in a single home of a gentleman named Anthony, not a gentleman,
no.
Anthony Soul. And it appears that he is a convicted rapist who was in that neighborhood. They have 170, actually, in that zip code, sexual offenders. And these women were women who had drug issues. Many of them had criminal pasts, you know, no major crimes that we know of yet. But they were women whose families often had lost track of them. They had been missing. Some were reported missing. Some weren't. But as it turns out, 11 of them ended up in this person's home. He is the man who is accused. He's been charged, I think, with only five of them so far. He's been indicted. Not indicted yet. And they are still digging, looking for more bodies. There have been several funerals now. And I ran a column this week earlier reaching out to the community because the police and the Cleveland Rape Crisis Center and people in the neighborhood are quite certain that there are other women who were victims of his, but they escaped. And we're trying to reach out to them to get them help.
Oh, I absolutely. And so the Rape Crisis Center there is offering their help. Because I can imagine the terror that these women are feeling. Plus, there's guilt that goes along with it, too, the fact that they got out and others didn't.
Well, and not only that, Nicole, as you and I talked earlier, one of the things that's been so disconcerting is that some people, particularly those who are more affluent and get to live in the suburbs, want to blame the women for being victims. You know, what kind of woman would hang out with this guy? Why would they have gone when he's online listed as a sexual offender? But, of course, if you've got drug issues, if you have mental health issues, you're not typically going to be somebody who's looking online to see who the sexual offenders are in the neighborhood. And the bottom line on this, I mean, the point is no woman deserves to be raped. No woman deserves to be attacked. No woman deserves to be murdered. So it is as the Rape Crisis Center has emphasized over and over again, if you want to blame anybody, you blame the perpetrator. If you want to expand the blame, you blame all of us because this was happening. You know, as I wrote in a column that's running tomorrow, I lived in this zip code for 11 years as a single mother. I mean, it's right across the border from Shaker Heights. And Shaker Heights is part of the same zip code. And we like to think that we're insulated from this. We like to think it couldn't happen to us. But, of course, you and I both know better. We both know survivors of rape. And we know how often it happens in circumstances where they actually know the offender and had no idea that they were that vulnerable to him.
Wow, it is a terrifying story, and I'm sure the entire city of Cleveland is just reeling from this news. Now, you just returned from Hong Kong, where you were a visiting lecturer at Baptist University, working with Chinese women who were allowed to leave mainland China for 1 year to study the principles of a free press, which that's a fascinating topic in and of itself. But what you wrote in this column, it was their very interesting response when I guess you told them of this story. We need to take a break in about 30 seconds, so I don't want to get into it now. But when we return, I want to sort of get into that and see how these Chinese women reacted to this story. Because in China, as you write, these women were the product of the one-child policy in China. All of them are only children, and they can't imagine a woman being, you know, missing and parents just being able to disappear like that. And Connie Schultz is with us. She's a columnist for The Plain Dealer. We'll return in a moment.
Sandler. You're listening to Nicole Sandler on Air America Radio.
And we are back with Connie Schultz, a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, who just returned from Beijing, where she was a visiting lecturer at the Baptist
University.
Actually,
Hong Kong.
Oh, I'm sorry, Hong Kong.
Okay.
I've got Beijing on my mind because of Paul Brandis. Yes. So how long were you over there?
I think, 11 days. And there were several of us journalists brought in to talk to students there, and I wasn't expecting that there would be so many female students. They come from mainland China for a year. It's a graduate program in journalism there, and it was about 80% women, which really surprised and delighted me. Yeah, and it's really sensory overload for them because they had only been there about 2 months. They, for the first time, can belong to Facebook. I think they've all friended me for a lot of them at this point, and They can get on the internet and look at international news in a way they weren't able to before. I noticed that a couple of them today posted that they weren't allowed to watch live when President Obama was speaking in China. That really struck them. You know, you get a little taste of freedom and you crave it.
Yes. Wow. So now, while you were over there, this story broke of these bodies being discovered.
Yes.
And the reaction that these women had.
You know, it was so interesting because the news was, I don't think I even told them about it first. It was breaking all around the world. And I think one of the students mentioned it to me right away. And I had just seen it that morning online. And the thing they kept saying to me is, how could they have been missing? How could their family not have wanted to know where they are? And, of course, these young women, a lot of them, they're gone for 2 hours without telling their parents where they are, and everybody's looking for them. So it was, and they wanted to know how it could happen in America. And of course, many, many awful things happened to women in China as well, as you and I know. But they were so focused on our country in terms of how this could even happen. And they knew they were women of color. And they knew they're taught a lot of bad history about America, not a lot of the good stuff, unfortunately. But they were so curious and they were not judgmental. They just wanted to know how it could have happened. And the pain in their faces really touched me, actually, and their questions and their probing. And it was a topic of conversation the entire time I was there.
Wow. Wow. So then you return home to Cleveland, and obviously this is, I mean, it's news everywhere, but this is right there in your hometown where you're a columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and this is it's got to be, the top story, of course, everywhere. As you said, they've still got the yellow tape around the house and digging for more bodies.
Yes. And the thing is, this city has been hit so hard already. I say this in my column tomorrow, and we've said this a lot here, that the foreclosure crisis was Cleveland's Katrina. And this neighborhood of Cleveland called Mount Pleasant was especially hit hard. So, and it used to be such a thriving neighborhood and so full of children and families, and it has just been devastated by the economic crisis and now this. And it's a town, I mean, you're in that neighborhood, and I describe them as the chronically bereaved. I mean, they have been hit so hard and so many times, and now this, and so many of us are full of questions right now. How could so many of these women had gone missing in this house? But, you know, we've got a list online. I was looking at it tonight. There are more than 500 women who've been reported missing in the city of Cleveland.
Wow.
I didn't even know it. So I looked online, and I looked, and I thought, oh, my God, what is happening here? What is happening to our women? And I'm cautioning, you know, the white suburban women like me who think that somehow, because we started to get complaints that we're covering it too much, which is why I wrote the column for tomorrow. And I just want to caution women that these are our sisters. We can pretend they're not. We can pretend we have, you know, that somehow we're gilded by privilege and smarts. But it's so easy to fall prey to that kind of thinking, and it's dangerous thinking for us. It's not just wrong in a social justice way. It's dangerous for our own well-being to think that way.
Well, I agree with you. Connie Schultz is with us. Now, one of the things, and it's sort of, it's not quite a natural segue, but I'm going to go there anyway.
Sure.
Because I think women have been sort of, we've placed ourselves, I think it's nature. I think it's part of being a woman. As mothers, you know, we put our children's needs first. We put our husband's needs first. And we sort of, we just take it on the chin. We figure, I'll be okay. We'll get through this. But I look back, and I'm thrilled with the great strides in the gay rights movement. I'm thrilled with the great strides we've made in race. I mean, we elected our first African-American president last year. But we still do not have the Equal Rights Amendment in this country for women.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
And seeing what happened last week with a majority of men in the U.S. House of Representatives and the STUPAC Amendment.
And too many women.
Yeah, and the STUPAC Amendment gets thrown in to this health care bill at the 11th hour. And what's going on here? I think all of a sudden we're saying, wait a minute, we're women and we're all, what are you doing to us?
Well, as you and I were talking earlier today, one of the things I think is really important to start emphasizing is that women's reproductive health is not a social issue. You know, whether I'm going to take a black purse or a red purse to dinner tomorrow night, whether I'm going to talk to my neighbors tomorrow and throw a party, those are social issues.
Yes.
Reproductive health is not. And I'm tired of it being called that, because when they are able to classify it that way, then it becomes open to debate whether it matters. And I do not think it's going to survive the Senate. I happen to have it on good words. But what really angers me is that it got this far, that it even became an issue. But, you know, when you were bringing up the whole notion of women's progress and how far we've come, Gail Collins' new book, I just reviewed it a couple weeks ago, When Everything Changed.
Uh-huh.
I highly recommend it,
okay,
especially to women, though, because what she did, she had 11 researchers who went out and talked to all kinds of women that we've never heard of before who lived during all this time of change from the 60s to now.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get a lot of regular voices talking about why it mattered what they went through and why it has mattered that they fought for change or were the beneficiaries of change or why they suffered because we hadn't had change yet. And I think it really serves as a wake-up call to a lot of us who want to think that we've made so much progress. All you have to do is look at the STUPAC moment, and, you know, you look at him tonight, he's all over the place saying, if it's not in it, this won't pass without it. And yes, it will. And he's becoming a caricature of himself, unfortunately, in terms of trying to oppress women's rights on this issue. But, my gosh, did you really – I didn't expect this, did you? I did not expect for us once again to become the volleyball.
No, not at all. And it's really getting me riled up.
Good.
Saying – exactly. So last week, as I told you, I had Eleanor Smeal on the air.
Yeah, Eleanor, great.
She's wonderful. She's still a fireball. She's still out there fighting for the right things.
Yes, she
but
is.
I think it might be time for women to – band together, and you know what? Maybe we do need the Equal Rights Amendment to get through. We don't need a bunch of old guys sitting in the House and the Senate telling us what we can and can't do with our bodies.
Well, not only that, we really need to make these men accountable. We had 6 Democrats in Ohio who supported the STUPAC Amendment. And one of the things that the pro-choice, you know, we have a lot of fairly wealthy pro-choice women in northern Ohio, where I live, in northeast Ohio. And they have made it clear that particularly the men from the southern part of the state who thought they were going to come back up here and raise any more money, they are done with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the message that needs to be communicated across the country to these men who thought, for some reason, who vowed they were going to be where we needed them to be on this issue and decided we were expendable, that not only are we not expendable, but we can withdraw support. Women have more money to give now than we've ever had. I mean, there are more of us working, more of us contributing. I leave myself out of the equation because I'm a journalist, but I'm speaking broadly in terms of women and their power. And it is time to start exercising that power. I just came on, this evening was the second night of two nights of teaching a seminar for the Op-Ed Project that runs seminars around the country, teaching women not just how to write opinion pieces, but how to own their opinions in the first place and to understand that they actually have a voice and that it's important that they have a voice of authority and they use it. And this is what I would want to encourage, especially your women listeners right now, is the time of silence is so behind us. And I wish women didn't need the invitation to participate, but apparently they still do. Too many of us still do. So I am issuing that invitation, as are you with your show and what you're saying tonight. We need more women to step up and insist that they will be heard and insist they will speak even when someone tells them they don't have the right to speak. I think of Maggie Kuhn, the founder of the Great Panthers, who said, speak your mind even if your voice shakes. I love that.
Yes.
And you say that in a crowd full of women, and especially middle-aged and older, you'll see women tear up when
you say it
because they so identify with that notion. You know, so many of us think we have to be really articulate before we speak. You really don't. And if you have a nervous voice, you can hush a room with it because everyone knows it must really matter to you because you're willing to step up and speak when you're so darn nervous.
Right. And that's the thing. But when you're being genuine, when you're being honest and open, it cuts through anything else. I happen to be covering, it was a few months back when all the healthcare debate was finally getting rolling, and I had Congressman Rob Andrews on the show. Well, just that day, my daughter, who is 10 years old, I was notified by her insurance company that they had canceled her months earlier. Never bothered to tell me.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, and I was talking to Rob Andrews about this, trying to be professional, and I my voice cracked. I started crying. I mean, because, you know, thinking of, again, it's my daughter. If I'm without insurance, I'll deal with it. I'll deal with it. But this is my kid who I would throw myself in front of a train for her, you know. I was actually taping the interview, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to leave it in because it's honest. And if I'm going through this, there's probably millions of people going through the same thing.
There are millions who are going through this. And I can only guess at the response. I mean, you know, we never hear from as many people as we can actually affect with a story. I am sure you had such an impact on so many, particularly women, because, as you know, you said earlier, mothers, I mean, one of the things I try to remind mothers all the time, when you're, and this came from an old friend of mine when I was going through a very difficult period of my life, back in the early 90s when I was going through a divorce. And, of course, I was completely focused on my kids, my job, my family, trying to keep everything together, and I was a wreck. And she sat me down, she came over and said, I need to talk to you. And she sat me down at the table and she says, when you're on an airplane, and they're telling you how to use the oxygen, and they say, if you have a child or a person next to you who needs help, what do they tell you to do?
Do them first.
Put your own on first.
Right.
And that's what I constantly try to remember. I'm going to remind you now because clearly you weren't listening. Put your own oxygen on first.
And then deal with them, yes.
Yes.
Right.
Because you'll be worth more to everyone else anyway around you. But you have to take care of yourself, Mom.
I know, and I keep trying to tell myself that. Connie Schultz is with us. Can you hang out for one more segment?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, great, because I do want to talk a little bit about your husband and how you balance life with a U.S. senator. Sherrod Brown is your husband. We're speaking with Connie Schultz. We'll be right back.
Nicole Sandler.
You're listening to Nicole Sandler on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Nicole Sandler on Air America Radio.
And we are back with Connie Schultz. She's a Pulitzer Prize winning columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, who actually took a leave of absence while her husband was running for the U.S. Senate. And, good news, he was elected. We have a wonderful Senator Sherrod Brown from Ohio, and you must be very proud.
Well, I'm incredibly proud of Sherry, especially because he has been such a, you know, he's been behind the public option from the very beginning, and he was the co-author of the public option in the HELP committee. Senator Kennedy had asked him and Senator Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island to write it. So he's not given up, and I am really proud of him. It's nice when you can agree with the person you're married with on so many issues, and I definitely do.
Most definitely. So is there, like, pillow talk? I mean, do you say, what is the deal with this Bart Stupak guy?
Actually, it was he already knew. He said he could hear me yelling before I picked up the phone. So he knows me pretty well on some of these things. And I realize sometimes it's a little hard for Sherry because he knows all these guys. You know, and he served in the House for 14 years before he was elected to the Senate. And we were married in 2004, so he knew them. He knew all of them before he knew me. But he never doubts where I'm going to be on an issue. And sometimes he really doesn't need to hear from me before he can anticipate the opinion.
Right, but it's great. I mean, on behalf of, you know, us, it's nice to know that you're there and you've got his ear.
Oh, thanks. Well, you know, he's really supportive of me, too. I mean, Sherrod and I were both longtime single parents when we met, and you better have a lot in common. I've said this often, when you get married in middle age, or you're just crazy to get married. And we fell in love pretty fast, and we were married a year and a half after we met, and our kids were all adults. You know, our youngest was my daughter, who was 16 at the time, and we've just been very fortunate. He is a true feminist. He's very supportive of me. And we've often said it's, but you know, we were strong for other people for so long that it's really nice to be strong for each other.
Well, after being on the campaign trail with him, as I said, you took a leave from the paper.
Yes, right.
During his campaign, and you were out campaigning for him. And you wrote the book, And His Lovely Wife, a memoir from the woman beside the man.
Yeah.
How is that from going from, you're a journalist. I mean, you're a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist.
Yeah, thank you. For all of, like, 6 months before I took the leave. And it was not something I expected to do. I had to take the leave. I mean, once
right.
we decided that Sherrod should run, and I don't know if you remember back then, but nobody thought Sherrod could win. He was running against a two-term incumbent Republican.
Right. There was also Paul Hackett thrown in there, too.
Right, and that was there for a little bit, and Paul got out pretty early. Sherrod ended up winning by 13 points. I mean, we knew a progressive could win in Ohio. I had to take a leave to avoid a conflict of interest, obviously.
Right.
I also didn't want to put my colleagues in constant predicaments because we are the largest paper in the state. And that was before I was syndicated. I was just writing for Ohio at that point. But I also wanted to be there for my husband. I wanted to be a wife to my husband in the biggest race of his career. So I had never campaigned, of course, because I've been a working journalist my entire adult life. It was a real experience. I learned an awful lot about the state. And once I decided to basically be who I am anyway, which is I go out and I listen to people's stories, and then I share their stories. So instead of writing about their stories, I was telling their stories. The book came about very early because Random House was already in the works publishing my first one, and Anna Quinlan, and Anna's been very supportive of me, and we have the same editor at Random House. As soon as she heard that Sherrod was running for the Senate, she called the editor and said, Sherrod Brown's running for the Senate. Well, I know his book I want to read, and it ain't the candidates. So,
yeah.
You know, I had a book deal before I left, which helped, knowing that I had that, and I knew I was going to have some place to put it all.
Right. Wow. What a great story. And you continue writing every day. People can read you online at cleveland.com.
Cleveland.com or at creators.com, either place. Yep.
Okay. Well, Connie Schultz, it's such a pleasure talking to you, and I hope
Thank
we can
you.
Do this again. You're a great voice out there, and it was just tough.
Well, so are you. It's
Thank
nice
you.
To have a partner out there. So thanks so much for the invitation. I appreciated it.
Well, I appreciate you staying up late with us tonight. Thanks so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Connie Schultz. Wow. What a cool, strong woman. You know, we need more of those. Now, in the next hour, we are going to be visited by yet another very cool, very strong woman, Kathy Griffin. I got to tell you, I never was really a fan of hers. I mean, I remember when she was on that sitcom Suddenly Susan, and right around the same time, there was another sitcom, News Radio, which, you know, I liked more because obviously it's set in a radio newsroom. Hello. And it also had a smart-ass, redhead, you know, sidekicky, funny woman who I thought she was more ballsy, more, I don't know, I liked her character better. And then I don't remember if I guess I saw My Life on the D-List a couple of times, and I actually liked her. I liked what I saw coming out of her. And then I met my boyfriend, and he happens to be he loves stand-up comedy. I've seen more stand-up shows, you know, since I've been dating my boyfriend. And we went and saw Kathy Griffin, and she was over the top hysterical. And this was at a big, not just a little comedy club, but she was playing the Hard Rock, you know, theater, which holds a few thousand people, and it was sold out. And she blew me away. And then I started watching My Life on the D-List more often, and the more I got to know about Kathy Griffin, the more I liked her. Well, I was offered the opportunity to interview her, and I said, yes, please. And I started reading the book, and seriously, I could not put it down. So I really respect this woman. The book tells a whole other side about her, things that you wouldn't ever know. But anyway, we'll talk about that with Kathy Griffin on the other side of this break. I'm Nicole Sandler. We are going to have some time for phone calls, I think, at the end. So if you want to chime in on anything, you're always welcome to 866-303-2270. We'll be back. We'll check in with Ellen Ratner from the Talk Radio News Service and then Kathy Griffin all coming up on Air America Radio. Don't go away.
You're listening to Nicole Sandler.
Nicole Sandler.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270.